Hello and welcome to Fast and Fair, the Climate Transition Podcast. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about positive impact. This episode is produced in collaboration with DLA Piper and recorded at the Conduit Studio at COP26 as part of a series exploring the role of the law in responding to climate change. Throughout this series, we're speaking to experts on climate justice and litigation, policymaking, human rights, finance and carbon literacy to understand how business, government and the third sector can work together to speed the transition to a just and sustainable future. The theme of this series is fast and fair, but what do we really mean by a just transition? What role does the law have to play, and how can we place Indigenous knowledge at the forefront of climate decision making? Today, I'm delighted to speak to Yasmin Ahmed, UK Director of Human Rights Watch, and Tishiko King, a Torres Strait Islander and a campaigner, to delve into these vital questions. Prior to joining Human Rights Watch, Yasmin was Executive Director of the multi-award-winning human rights organization, Rights and Security International. During her tenure, they successfully litigated and advocated on issues ranging from arms sales to Saudi Arabia to investigations into crimes committed by government forces in Afghanistan. Yasmin has worked as a public international lawyer for the UK and Australian governments and the UN. Tishiko King is a proud Zenadith Kess Torres Strait Island woman and the campaign director at SEED, Australia's first Indigenous youth climate network. During and after her studies in ocean science at Griffith University, Tish, as she likes to be called, has been actively involved with local grassroots organizing environmental groups across Australia and overseas. Tish believes in working towards a sustainable future for First Nations by rebalancing the human-nature interaction central to the culture and traditional practices. Yasmin, we know that climate change is the most significant global threat to human rights we've seen in our lifetime. So how are climate-caused natural disasters already exacerbating inequality and human rights crises?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So you're absolutely right. It's central to our consideration of the challenges that human beings are going to be facing over the next century and beyond. Human Rights Watch has done some really important studies looking at the intersection of climate change, particularly for vulnerable communities. So, and already marginalised communities. So we've looked at the impact of climate change on Indigenous communities, on people with disabilities and also on the elderly. And what we found time and again is it only serves to exacerbate the already existing inequalities and human rights concerns that these individuals face.
So we have with us in the form of Tish a person who is a living embodiment of the climate impacts on Indigenous people in particular. So tell us a little bit about the lived experience of your communities and how climate change is placing them a threat.
Yeah, thank you for that, Paul. And sort of exactly what you just said, Yasmin, you know, we're already facing inequalities, you know, adding on, you know, the climate impacts. And so as a proud Torres Strait Island woman, you know, we live by the ocean, live by the land, and right now, you know, our islands are threatened by already overfishing, coral bleaching, you know, inundation and sea levels rising. But, you know, with the added, you know, exacerbation of the climate crisis, you know, it's been more detrimental to, you know, our cultural connection, you know, our history impacting, you know, our lands and islands. And so, like you just said, Yasmin, it's, you know, it's more than just, you know, climate. It's the inequalities that still exist for those marginalized groups, First Nations groups, Indigenous groups globally.
So Yasmin, what do you think governments can and should be doing to square up to what is a growing and, you know, potentially irreversible trend
And tell us some examples of Human Rights Watch's work that specifically tries to address this phenomenon.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think on the meta level, on the general level, I mean, it's emissions need to be cut and at a significantly increased rate than governments are committing to. We all know that. That absolutely has to be done. We were really, really excited to see yesterday that there was an agreement on deforestation, on the Forestries Agreement, and that there was money pledged and that Indigenous communities and human rights was at the centre of that agreement. Obviously, it's all going to be about implementation, which it always is, because these are commitments and these commitments need to be fulfilled. In terms of the work of Human Rights Watch, so in addition to highlighting and working with grassroots and global communities who are calling for this same thing, we've also been working with communities, particularly in Canada, looking at the impact on those communities that I talked about previously, so persons with disabilities, ageing communities and Indigenous communities. And what we're saying is that governments on a more micro level need to have proper and adequate systems to respond to what we know are devastating crises that are arising from the climate. So we had the extreme heat wave that hit Canada earlier this year. Over 500 people died. And I think it was about 75 or 65% of those people were over the age of 75. So there was an incredible impact on aging communities. But what we're seeing is that governments, and particularly in this example, the Canadian government was not prepared for this at all. And neither were the kind of regional governments either. And so what we're saying is that not only do they need to be prepared for this, but communities that are impacted, so the communities I've been speaking about, need to be at the heart of the response. They need to be consulted with, and they need to be the ones determining what they need and how we should respond. What we see time and time again with our research is that, in fact, Indigenous communities are the solution to the problems in relation to climate. They can unlock that in so many ways. They have solutions in how we should respond. And they also are, for example, in relation to deforestation, they're our guardians. Studies have shown time and time again that Indigenous communities protect. They are the best protectors. But unfortunately, they're the ones that are often subject to human rights abuses in relation to their not only just accessing their land, but also trying to protect their land. So what we're saying, really, there needs to be both the commitment on the larger scale to reducing emissions, to ensuring that they live up to their commitments on emissions and deforestation, and also in relation to divesting from fossil fuels and putting it into to alternatives. But there also needs to be adequate responses to what we know are devastating consequences that are happening globally, and that the impacted communities need to be centered in those responses.
So Tish, Yasmin, I think, put it very eloquently that in Indigenous communities are often the guardians of nature, and I know you know that from firsthand experience. So tell us a little bit about your work, your activism, what you and your organization do with your community.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, you hit the nail on the head with that one. Like, First Nations people, Indigenous people across the globe, make up, less than 5% of the population, yet look after, 80% of the biodiversity. And, we are seeing that, unfortunately, because of the crisis, First Nations people, Indigenous people, people of colour, marginalised groups are hit, first and worst, yet, didn't contribute to those impacts. And so, it's something that I proudly work for, a grassroots organisation called Seed Indigenous Youth Climate Network, where we actually are Australia's first and only youth-led organisation, and really have been building a movement to protect country, land and culture from, climate impacts and, fossil fuel extraction as well. And it's something that we feel proud, because we are giving back that self-determination from those other colonial impacts. Because what we say is that it's about climate justice, because there is a deeper root injustice to this crisis.
So Yasmin, in the wake of COVID and with the pressing and ongoing challenge of climate change, certain supranational groups, the European Union in particular, have introduced standards both in relation to ESG and in relation to human rights pertaining to companies operating within their jurisdictions. And I'd love to get your sense of, is this a step forward? Are they adequate? What more could be done in this regard? Tell us a little more.
Yeah, thank you. It's a really good question. So yes, Human Rights Watch and many other civil society organisations have been really pushing governments to say that you need to be ensuring that companies are not investing in and part of the problem, their supply chains and how they're working. So essentially what we've been doing is working in the European Union, working in the UK, the US and elsewhere, and saying that your due diligence laws, so laws on companies that require them to do due diligence in relation to their supply chain, need to encompass human rights and need to encompass environmental considerations. And so what we've seen is an introduction in the EU of such laws. Well, it's going through at the moment, and likely to go through. We've seen a similar law happening in the UK in relation to deforestation. And we're also seeing something proposed in the US. In terms of how they are and what more they can be doing and what we're pushing for. So one of the main things that we are saying in relation to deforestation in particular is that it's not sufficient to talk only about illegal deforestation. And while that would seem strange to some, because obviously we would be saying it should encompass illegal deforestation. In many countries in the world, deforestation, which is impacting climate change significantly, has not been made unlawful. And in particular, the rights of Indigenous persons are not necessarily recognised over that land. And so what we're saying is that it's absolutely essential for these laws to encompass not only unlawful deforestation, but to respect the rights of the Indigenous communities to their land, to ensure that there's fair, open and transparent consultation with these communities, and that consent is given in an adequate and proper way. So what we've seen in the US is some really interesting introduction of what could potentially look like, whereby there would be a designation put on certain countries who are deemed to be at risk of being implicated. But in order to determine what are at-risk countries, and this is the key, there would be consultation done not only with the government but with civil society, Indigenous communities in those countries to determine the extent to which they are at risk and deforestation is at risk. And then if those countries have been found to be at risk, then any company who is doing business with and in relation to commodities that are related to deforestation would be under a requirement to do due diligence and would have to prove what due diligence they have done. So what essentially we're saying is it needs to be rigorous. It needs to be done in a manner that is not just superficial, but actually has the impact. One last thing I would say, unfortunately, what we've seen, this has not always come about, and what we're hoping in the UK, we've just passed an environment bill in the UK, and now we've got regulations which are going to be implemented in relation to that. And what we're really hoping is that we will see this in the regulations, because it's great for the leaders to come to COP and make big pledges, and we think those pledges are necessary. But actually, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding will be in these regulations. Will the UK government be happy to ensure that these things are actually taken account of and that businesses who are operating these countries are doing so in a manner that does not destroy the environment and respects Indigenous rights?
So that's an example of how the law can be used to change the conduct and monitor and surveil the conduct of corporations. You, Tish, have been involved in a campaign and in a case before the Human Rights Committee to try and get the Australian government to take more assertive action, particularly in relation to the plight of the Torres Strait Islanders. So tell us a little bit about the case, because I think it's both landmark and interesting in a range of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So for folks out there, the campaign is called Our Islands, Our Home, which is a collaboration, incredible collaboration with our incredible lawyers, Client Earth in the UK, Seed Mob, where I'm at, the GBK, the Land and Sea of the Torres Strait Council that govern like the native title, and the incredible 350 Australia, who are supporting the 8 Torres Strait claimants who have taken a case with the United Nations Human Rights Committee for accusing Australian government for their lack of inaction to reduce their emissions. And so, with these changing shifts with the environment, it's not a shift anymore. It's a crisis, because the urgency is now, because they're being impacted now. And it goes back to what you said, Yasmin, before about, the rights of Indigenous people to free, prior and informed consent, the consultation, the process. There's a lot of lacking, conversation and transparency to it, that here we are having to fight to make sure that we stay on our island, stay on our land, because you are right, we are so connected to our islands, we are the island. So when our lands and homes are hurting, so are we, because it does provide us with our food, it does provide us with our medicine, our health, our stories, our history is deeply embedded and rooted into it. And so it's not just a loss of homes, it's a loss of culture.
And as I understand, part of your central argument is it's not just a loss exactly as your homes, but your cultural identity is embedded in those islands, and you've been there for centuries and centuries. And if those islands were to fall beneath the waves, you would lose not just the safety and sanctity of a place, but you would also be placing your culture at risk, and it could extinguish your culture.
Absolutely, and especially in Australia, it would be a second base of dispossession of land again. And so that's exactly right, bringing back all around what it means, that human rights and the impacts it does have on our people.
So for those people listening in, one of the things I would urge you to do is go and have a look at this case, because it's a landmark case. It's before the Human Rights Committee. The Australian government has not fully and adequately responded, at least in my personal judgment. But it would set a really important precedent if you were to win on behalf of Indigenous people, but also in terms of formulating a right under human rights law to think about the rights and interests of future generations and the cultural rights of Indigenous people. So to that end, Yasmin, I'd like to ask you, everybody has spoken about the climate-induced population movements, tens of millions of climate refugees. And the Torres Strait Islanders are a case of where you may have an entire people having to move from one place to another because they can literally no longer live in a place where they've lived for centuries, and amplify that across Bangladesh and a bunch of other vulnerable nations. You can see a trend. Mm-hmm. So what are the current legal protections afforded to climate refugees, mm-hmm. and what more could be done to protect the rights of climate refugees?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And I think you're absolutely right that, it is particularly from within Human Rights Watch, it's something that we are also obviously very focused on, looking at how do we respond globally to the fact that the climate change is going to mean that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are going to be displaced from their homes. So I would say, the first thing I would say is that we have a really worrying trend that is happening globally, and that relates to the system of protection of people who are seeking refuge. And why that's relevant is because the protections that already exist for people who are seeking refuge from persecution are being unpicked and undermined as we speak. So you only need to look at what's happening on the border of France and the UK in Calais, or at the pushbacks that are happening in Greece, or the people that are being offshored in Nauru, to see the fact that the global community is not responding to the crisis that we have now in relation to refugees and migrant communities more generally. And we are very concerned about what that is going to mean for people who are seeking refuge from climate-induced concerns. So I think where we what we have now is, and I mean, it is an impetus, and I think one thing that's very interesting and why I think global communities, in fact, and the global leaders are responding, is no one can insulate themselves from the impacts of climate change. No country can do that, both from a perspective of obviously the weather. We've seen, you know, a multiplicity of what that looks like across the world in natural disasters, but it also in terms of climate refugees. And so I think what we will be seeking to do is reinforce the protections that exist and the frameworks that exist. But the global community needs to make sure that there is adequate protection and safeguards and prior planning. What we don't want is people to be displaced and leaving and having to leave in a way where they're evacuating at the last minute. There needs to be proper prior planning for how these communities, and also that really comes back to being ensuring to what extent can we make sure that we can maintain their connection, because that really should be the absolute last, you know, the last avenue that we should be looking at.
So I'm going to ask both of you the following question, and you may have variant takes on it. But I think one of the challenges with climate refugees is that, and climate and the refugee law, is that the protection of refugees historically has emerged from a sense that people are either being subject to persecution, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, subject to war. They are the victims of human malevolence. The problem with the climate is that although the climate change is directly caused by humans, it's more amorphous. It's more difficult to attribute responsibility to it. And therefore, it's more difficult, both in legal terms, I think, but also in human terms, to build up the sort of sympathy you have for climate refugees that you may have for refugees fleeing Syria or the Holocaust or other contexts where we're able to get a greater sense of human traction. Now, in some ways, you and your people are the human face and an incredibly sympathetic human face, I might add, of what climate refugees could look like. So tell us how you campaign and how you are planning to campaign in the context of this very difficult challenge ahead of us.
You're right. Like, people are still missing, you know, that connection and that understanding of, like, while an environment is shifting, who's it really for, like, impacting? And so the way that we campaign is truth-telling, but in a way that people can hear by sharing our story, sharing our culture, so that people understand what we're losing, so that they know what we're fighting to protect. You know, it's like you said, you know, Indigenous peoples right across the globe have been looking after their lands for time immemorial. We know how to look after land with the practices, with our traditional practices. And so, you know, with all of this, it just, I guess it's about sharing that, implementing back into systems, you know, embedding that back into, you know, Western knowledge, so that, you know, we are bridging that together to create that sustainable future, sharing our culture so that together we walk shoulder to shoulder, you know, in this fight for a future for all. And it is alarming, but, you know, with that we have hope. You know, we're showing our strength and resilience, and that we are continuing to fight and stand up proudly and, you know, keep fighting for culture, for country, for our homes.
So, Yasmin, how do we unpick this problem in legal terms?
Well, it is a really interesting problem. As you said, how do we now look at you know, refugees who are seeking, you know, refuge from climate impacts. And I think it's going to require a considerable rethinking of the protection architecture that we have in the world. And no doubt it will require courts and require international organisations to start, and no doubt they're doing that already, which we know they are, to consider how this protection regime can take account of people who will be displaced by virtue of climate change. I think very importantly, the point you made as well was, you know, how do we sensitize people to this prior to it potentially happening as well? Because, as you said, it is going to be one thing to talk to people about people fleeing Afghanistan, which we've all seen very recently, and we've seen the faces of people leaving the Taliban and fleeing from the Taliban. But it's quite another to have whole populations having to leave their homes. So I think both from an advocacy and a legal perspective, it is certainly a challenge that we and others are looking to confront.
So the Human Rights Commission has recently recognised that having a clean, healthy and sustainable environment mm-hmm. is a human right. Mm-hmm. So does that give us the seed of a hope that if you begin to classify climate as a human rights mm-hmm. issue mm-hmm. in the way that not being tortured or assassinated or disappeared is a human rights issue, or not being discriminated against is a human rights issue, does that give us some hope that you may be able to advance the law in the direction that that we've been discussing?
I think definitely. And we were delighted to see that resolution passed, the last Human Rights Council. And as you said, what is so important about that is it gives people tangible rights, as you were talking about, tangible rights to say that we have a right to clean air, to healthy oceans, to all of the things that we need to survive and thrive. So for Indigenous communities, it's important, and for people more generally, it's important. And this is not new. What we've seen is in, you know, a multiplicity of jurisdictions around the world, and even in constitutions, we've seen this right being materialised and also given effect to. And I think this, what we saw at the Human Rights Council, was now a global recognition of that right, and it's starting to take form, as I said, in those particular ways. So I think it's a really important and exciting development.
If you could write in to a final manifesto or declaration what Indigenous people could get out of a COP that truly took their rights into account, what would you want that declaration to say?
That Indigenous people have a right to say what happens to their land, that they have the rights to decide, you know, what happens to it, you know, and can live and grow off it. What's to say, really? I don't even know where to start, because here we are at a COP26 and we're still trying to fight for those rights. Clean water, like you said, you know, clean air, access to that water, being able to, you know, practice your culture by, you know, using traditional practices, being able to cultivate our land like we can cultivate, that will help cultivate, you know, our, who we are. As you know, I often say that we are country, and so if we look after country, we are looking after ourselves. And so we are at a crucial time in our lives right now, and the way that we are occupying this planet is just not working anymore. And so we have to work together to collectively, you know, take action for, you know, like you said, a just future for all, so we can thrive and survive.
So Yasmin, 20 years ago, Human Rights Watch probably didn't put climate at the top of its programming agenda. The inverse risk is now potentially true, that climate is at the top of everybody's agenda and human rights slips down the agenda. So if you were to, in that same COP manifesto, insert language, but not just language, also meaningful action and meaningful protections around human rights into the climate conversation, what would you want to see the leaders of COP say about the intersection between human rights and climate?
Well, first of all, the acknowledgement of it. And I think what's very clear from this and other conversations that I've had with kind of global policymakers and leaders is that we've got we've got to a stage now where people, most people, have recognised that we have a climate crisis. The second stage is looking at how we centre and how human rights are part of that and what that means for us as humanity. And I think first and foremost, I would say to those leaders now who are signing the agreements, who are looking forward, to say that the communities that are going to be impacted, that are at the heart of the climate crisis, both by virtue of impact, but really importantly, by virtue of the solutions, that they are centred. What we've seen again and again, and even in relation to the really exciting forest agreement, for example, that was announced yesterday, Indigenous communities were not consulted and were not at the heart of that agreement. Until leaders and until the world sees that Indigenous communities, people with disabilities, ageing populations who are experiencing this on the front line, who have the solutions to the problems, are at the centre of the conversations, we are not going to be able to move forward. It's about, and I think you said it beautifully, it's about also humility. We've come full circle. We thought we had the solutions to the world and that we were progressing. And what we have to be now is humble and recognising that, in fact, the solutions may lie elsewhere, and they do. And unless we bring the people with the knowledge into our conversations and centre them, we won't move forward effectively.
It's been such a great pleasure speaking to both of you, both in terms of your activism and the work that you do, but also to so eloquently bring both a sense of the human costs of the climate crisis, how those need to be recognised. But as you've said, in recognizing the human costs and giving voice to people who are too often marginal and invisible, you also can tip over to some of the solutions that are going to take us there. And I think that that leaves us on an appropriate note of hopefulness. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode produced in partnership with DLA Piper. Feel free to subscribe, rate, and review. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms on the Conduit Conversations channel. For more information on the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com. DLA Piper is committed to making businesses better by helping clients and communities transition to and thrive in a more sustainable future. To find out more, please visit dlapiper.com/SESG. DLA Piper is committed to making businesses better by helping clients and communities transition to and thrive in a more sustainable future. To find out more, please visit dlapiper.com/SESG.